Today is Monday, July the 1st, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Lori London in Washington. Coming up, Donald Trump becomes the first sitting president in the U.S. to enter North Korea on Sunday.
It's worrisome that this president erratically sets up a meeting without the staff work being done. It seems like it's all for show. It's not substantive.
Deadly statistics on the number of migrant deaths worldwide. Also ahead, a gathering of thousands to celebrate a milestone for the LGBTQ community. It's all on today's International Edition. Well, now that Donald Trump has become the first U.S. president to enter North Korea while in office, the question is, what is next must be asked. That's what VOA Asia's Ira Melman asks Evans Revere, former U.S. State Department official dealing with East Asian and Pacific affairs. Melman began his conversation by asking whether President Trump's style of diplomacy through personal relationship could actually work.
It remains to be seen how this is going to turn out. I am a skeptic. Many years of dealing with the North Koreans and a pretty good sense of what their bottom line has been and continues to be makes me deeply skeptical that this process is going to end up with a success.
Why wouldn't a new approach work? Why couldn't a new approach work as one man who understands another man?
I am all in favor of new and different and alternate approaches, and during the course of many years working on these issues, tried just about, or recommended just about, every approach that is imaginable, including this one. The problem that we have here is that regardless of the approach, the North Korean bottom line has not changed. And we saw that based on what we observed in Singapore and, more importantly, what we observed in Hanoi. The North Korean leader, the North Korean system, they are determined to hold on to the core components of their nuclear weapons program at virtually any cost.
The word denuclearization was, I don't believe, brought up by Donald Trump or Kim Jong-un in the remarks they made after their meeting. What is wrong with not doing it the other way, by releasing or reducing some of the actions that have been taken against them economically? And why not let them be a nuclear power?
Well, first of all, one of the key sources of leverage for the United States in these negotiations are economic sanctions and the pressure that is on North Korea. In the past, in previous administrations, the United States tried the easing of sanctions, and that did not lead to denuclearization. It led to quite the opposite. So we learned some very hard lessons back in the day, both in the Clinton administration and the Bush administration. We learned some very tough lessons from the North Koreans about their determination to hold on to their nuclear capacity, regardless of the U.S. approach. We held out the prospect of a presidential visit in the Clinton administration, and President Clinton personally rejected that because he was not convinced, with good reason, that the North Koreans were prepared to conclude a deal with him. President Trump has obviously reached a different conclusion, hence his three summits and his stepping across the border into North Korea. But with respect to your other point, why not let them be and let them continue on the path that they're on? Keep in mind that the North Koreans have actually threatened to use nuclear weapons against the United States. They are developing the capabilities to carry out that threat. This is a country that has shown certain capacities and capabilities that are pretty barbaric over the years. And beyond that, North Korea is not accepted by the international community as a nuclear weapons state, unlike the United States and China, et cetera. And to allow North Korea to have violated its international obligations by developing a nuclear weapons program, it would further do damage to the international nonproliferation regime.
Do you expect anything positive to happen coming out of what happened near the DMZ with President Trump walking in to North Korea?
I'm absolutely convinced that the North Koreans are determined to hold on to their nuclear weapons, but that doesn't mean that they will not sit down and talk and make proposals and counter-proposals to the United States. And I think the one thing that is most likely to come out of this encounter on the DMZ is the resumption of high-level, working-level talks between American representatives and North Korean representatives. So I think what you saw in Panmunjom a few hours ago was a masterful piece of political theater made for television drama, some feel-good made for television moments. But substantively, I would argue that we are no better off than we were before that meeting, because on the substantive side, the North Koreans have not changed their position. And I hope to heaven that the United States has not changed its position of a determined pursuit of the denuclearization of North Korea.
All right. That's VOA Asia's Ira Melman speaking with former U.S. State Department official and Asia-Pacific expert Evans Revere. Here are some of the stories we're following at voanews.com. Japan will resume its commercial whaling. Five killed as thousands rally in Sudan to demand civilian rule. The White House says a trade agreement with China is not close. Gay pride marches in the U.S. mark 50 years of modern gay rights movement. Find expanded coverage of these stories and much more at voanews.com and on our VOA mobile app. This is International Edition. The International Organization for Migration says that more than 32,000 migrants worldwide have died or gone missing between 2014 and 2018, with most fatalities occurring on the deadly Mediterranean Sea, crossing from North Africa to Europe. Lisa Schlein reports for VOA from IOM headquarters in Geneva.
The UN Migration Agency says its global figures underestimate the true nature and extent of the problem, as many migrant deaths are never reported and many bodies are never recovered. Nevertheless, researchers say the statistics paint a very grim picture of the perils awaiting the hundreds of thousands of refugees and migrants risking their lives in search of protection or a better life. The report shows nearly 18,000 people have died or gone missing in the Mediterranean between 2014 and 2018. It says the remains of almost two-thirds of those victims have not been found. IOM spokesman Joel Millman says Rohingya refugees comprise the vast majority of the 2,200 deaths recorded in Southeast Asia, and most of the 288 deaths recorded in South Asia since 2014 were of Afghan migrants.
Despite the conflict in Yemen, people continue to attempt the sea crossing from the Horn of Africa across the Red Sea and the Gulf of Aden. At least 125 people drowned off the shores of Yemen in 2018, compared with 53 in 2017. And an increasing number of deaths on the United States-Mexico border have been recorded each year since 2014. The total we have over the 5 years is 1,907.
Millman tells VOA that the numbers included in IOM's Missing Migrants Project are defined as people in transit. He says there's a separate category for people who die in custody, though exceptions do occur. He says recent cases of people who have died while in custody for less than 2 hours are included in the current database.
In general, in transit is the rule of thumb, but we have had some cases, I think six or seven already this year, of recently in custody in the U.S. or recently released from custody that have resulted in deaths within a few days. And those we parse the best we can for the database.
A related report recently released by IOM and the UN Children's Fund focuses on the growing number of children embarking on dangerous migrant journeys. The data finds nearly 1,600 children, about one every day, were reported dead or missing between 2014 and 2018. Researchers add the full extent of this tragedy is unknown, as many of these migrant child deaths go unrecorded. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
Well, according to the U.S. Chamber of Commerce Foundation, there are more jobs available now in the U.S. than people to fill them for the first time in our nation's history. And now employers are increasingly recognizing that the growing population of Americans with criminal records could help fill the gap. The foundation's recent America Working Forward project, Hidden Workforce, Why Businesses Are Welcoming Employees with Criminal Records, explores employer-led programs that give inmates and ex-offenders training and support as they re-enter the workforce. And it takes an in-depth look at some of the businesses, entrepreneurs, and nonprofits who are building pathways to employment for formerly incarcerated individuals. Joining us to talk more about this is Chamber Foundation Vice President Mike Carney. You noted that this is the first time in our nation's history there are actually more jobs than there are people available to fill them. That's somewhat of a good problem to have, particularly when it comes to people that may have trouble getting jobs, including people that are ex-offenders trying to get a leg up and have a new start.
Yeah, I couldn't say it any better myself, Lori. The case for hiring ex-offenders in this magazine is pretty strong. And actually, we have an essay in the magazine from the Los Angeles Area Chamber of Commerce where they go through point by point and show employers how they can benefit from tapping into this hidden work.
Is there still a hesitance to hire people who have been incarcerated? Do they have hesitation? Do they have concerns? Or do they seem pretty open to the idea?
So we didn't do a survey of employers, but it stands to reason that this is an entirely new population for many companies. And with a new population and potentially scary characteristics would come some trepidation. So the whole point of this project was to go out and learn a little bit more about businesses that are finding ways to provide training and provide opportunities that lead to quality jobs, and then chronicle those stories or capture those stories in a way that other businesses could learn from. Because we assume there is some hesitation, but one of the things that we've learned over the past year is that this is not easy to do, but it's a lot easier than you'd think.
What are you hearing about the folks that are getting jobs for the first time, how they are responding to probably somewhat of a challenge in the beginning, I would imagine?
One of the things that really jumped out at me as we were doing this work is that for many of the people who have gone through programs that lead to employment, we describe it as a second chance. But in reality, for many of them, it's a first chance. What has really made a difference in the lives of those ex-offenders is the training programs focus just as much on the soft skills that many people take for granted as on the hard skills that you need to do a specific job. And by offering access to training on dispute resolution and how to show up work on time and how to de-escalate situations and how to handle money and how to do culinary math, all of those skills come together and they build a level of confidence in ex-offenders that, by all accounts, is a very valuable tool in helping them reduce the risk of returning to prison.
And I wonder if maybe some of these folks are actually even more grateful than other people that may be, you know, going to their work feeling like it's the daily grind, yet you have these people that are maybe even more motivated and have a better attitude because they're grateful to be able to have this chance?
I think it's really hard to generalize across this population, in part because it is so large. More than 73 million Americans having a criminal record of some sort. There are all different kinds of people being captured as ex-offenders. You have people who go through coding programs at San Quentin and end up working in the technology space. You have other people who come out and they start their own business. We have some amazing stories in the magazine that's on our website that tell how one really inspirational guy went from being a drug dealer in New York to the owner and operator of a fast-growing fitness company that creates jobs for other ex-offenders. And in fact, one of his trainers ranked by Reebok as one of the top trainers in America.
Wow, that's cool. How big of a problem was it prior to this sort of shift in the workforce needs for ex-offenders to get jobs?
That's a great question. We don't have a lot of historical data. There are no, to my knowledge, no databases that list how many ex-offenders were hiring 20 years ago versus today. But what I can tell you is that the business community increasingly looking to this population and finding really talented people.
All right, that is U.S. Chamber of Commerce Foundation Vice President Mike Carney. Thank you for being with us. You're listening to International Edition on VOA.
Voice of America's news, talk, and music programs are now at the tip of your fingers. Find everything at www.voaafrica.com. Listen to VOA's program lineup live, anytime, day or night. Pick out your favorite shows and listen anytime you want. Download our podcasts. Check VOA Mobile from your cell phone. Subscribe to VOA Newsfeed. VOAnews.com.
Jazz America.
This is Russ Davis, and on my program Jazz America, I carry on the tradition begun decades ago by the great Willis Conover by exploring the wonders of a century of jazz history. I'll cover it all from Dixieland to swing to bebop to modal, free jazz, fusion, world jazz, contemporary, and beyond. Plus, you'll hear the words of the artists themselves as they tell their incredible stories. Join me for Jazz America, Saturdays and Sundays at 13 hours Universal Time, online at voanews.com and the Voice of America.
VOA's International Edition continues. Well, at the weekend box office, the horror sequel Annabelle Comes Home opened in line with expectations, but the Cinderella story of the weekend was actually the third place movie yesterday about the Beatles. We'll get reviews on both of those films and also the new Spider-Man movie that's about to open. Well, for all of this, we are joined by Vegas film critic Jeffrey K. Howard. Jeff, so what's the deal with the new Spider-Man film? What's it all about?
This is with Tom Holland, who's our new Spider-Man. He was in the Avengers movies. He also had his debut last summer with Homecoming. And this was really brilliant because with the Avengers and the Walt Disney Company, Sony was smart to partner up with them because Marvel's characters are strung out all over different studios over the last couple of decades. Who owns rights to what character? The X-Men and the Fantastic Four, 20th Century Fox, which now Disney bought, so they come back home. But Spider-Man was always licensed out years ago to Sony, Columbia Pictures. But their standalone films weren't doing that well. So it was brilliant for them to merge with the Disney people to include him in the Avengers when he made that cameo a couple of years ago. And that just sent Spider-Man's popularity through the roof. So now they did not only Homecoming, where we have a totally new Spider-Man with Tom Holland, but now this is a post-Endgame Avengers movie with Far From Home. Tony Stark, it opens with the movie, you know, he's gone. And he was a mentor figure to Spider-Man, and he told Spider-Man, look, you know, I think you have what it takes to be an Avenger. But you got to remember, Peter Parker is a teenager. So in Far From Home, he's taking a trip to Europe, to Italy, to Paris, with his high school class, with his best friend. And, of course, Nick Fury shows up, played by Samuel Jackson, and says, look, we have a threat. You're an Avenger. We need you. The world needs you, because we have a new villain, played by Jake Gyllenhaal, Mysterio, who's here to battle these elementals of the Earth. We don't know if he's a good guy or a bad guy, kind of a twist. But Peter Parker is, like, conflicted. He wants to spend time with MJ, played by Zendaya. He wants to give her a necklace. He wants to kiss her on the Eiffel Tower. He wants to be 16. So it's really a great dynamic to see them going back and forth, where he has a responsibility to being Spider-Man and also to be a teenager. So Jake Gyllenhaal is fantastic as Mysterio. Tom Holland is great. It's just a really great summer action film. It's one of the best Spider-Mans, and after we've had seven of them or eight of them, and I loved it. I had a great time with it.
Very cool. All right. Good recommendation. And, you know, it seems like the season of doing biopics of famous musicians. We've had the one about Elton John, Rocket Man. We had Bohemian Rhapsody about Queen, Freddie Mercury. And now we've got Yesterday.
Yeah, we've got the Beatles. And this is a really great romantic comedy from screenwriter Richard Curtis, who gave us some of the greatest British comedies of all time. Love Actually, Notting Hill, Four Weddings and a Funeral. And this movie has a great fantasy premise. What if the world never had the Beatles music? What if you woke up and you were the only one that remembers all of the Beatles songs and the rest of the world didn't? And you're a struggling musician. And this musician is played by Himesh Patel, who can sing every Beatles song like it's the first time. So here's a character where he wants to be a musician. He's tried for many, many years. And now he's like in a situation, do I pass off the Beatles songs as my own and become this worldwide sensation? So it is hysterical. And even Ed Sheeran plays himself in the movie, and it's more than a cameo. He has a supporting role. He's great. And Kate McKinnon from Saturday Night Live, she plays his manager.
Wow.
So it is, yeah, it's a really great romantic comedy directed by the great Danny Boyle. And if you love the music of the Beatles, this is a love letter to it. And I remember seeing Himesh Patel here at CinemaCon in Las Vegas back in April when they were promoting the film. He came out and spoke to the crowd and sang Yesterday just with his guitar, and he's fantastic. So this is a great romantic comedy with the Beatles music supporting it. It's a good time.
Very cool. All right, and then we've got that the latest in the Annabelle trilogy?
It's the third one, yes. Annabelle is a standalone. This is from the Conjuring series, you know, from producer James Wan. Mm-hmm. And Annabelle is that doll that's possessed, you know, that channels demons. And, of course, the Warrens are back, and everything in their basement at their house of Ed and Lorraine Warren, everything from all their assignments, have all these objects that are cursed. Well, of course, they go off on another assignment. They leave their 10-year-old with the babysitter, played by McKenna Grace. And, of course, they go down and start messing with everything in the basement, and they start messing with Annabelle, who gets loose and starts all this carnage going on. This is a great ghost story. It's got great mood. It's got great suspense. It is rated R, but you know what? It is a great, great thriller, and I just loved it. And it's just something that the summer movie season just begs for. You're going to love this new installment of Annabelle Comes Home.
All right, Jeffrey K. Howard, thank you so much. You can find us full video reviews at VegasFilmCritic.com. Well, thousands of people from around the world converged Friday on the Stonewall Inn in New York City for the 50th anniversary of the rebellion that catalyzed an uprising for LGBTQ liberation. Celebrities like Lady Gaga marked the milestone with performances, personal reflections, and speeches. Here's Lady Gaga.
This community has fought and continued to fight a war of acceptance, a war of tolerance, and the most relentless bravery. You are the definition of courage. Do you know that? I feel so honored and privileged to even be asked to be here.
We love you!
I feel that privilege and that honor because today, what it truly is this is a celebration of all of you in every single way. I would never degrade the fight you have all endured, the adversity that you have all been through to truly be seen, to be heard, or the struggles that you've been through to love yourselves and to seek really love you. You are strong. You are so strong. You welcomed me into your community in the most beautiful of ways that I will never forget. My whole life changed because of you. I'm trembling speaking to you. You're making me nervous. The universe brought us together in the spirit of kindness. And we, together, we're a powerhouse. And I hope, I really, really hope you celebrate every inch of who you are today. You were born this way, and you're a superstar. My mom's here today. My dad. I'm a New Yorker. The Germanatas are out in full force. We're all here for you. And I thank you, Mom, for running the Born This Way Foundation. Unheard of to even come out of the closet or be expected in any way declare who you are. But now, children at very young ages are saying, Mommy or Daddy, I'm gay. I'm a lesbian. Mommy or Daddy, I'm bi. They're saying, Mommy or Daddy, I'm not a girl, I'm a boy. They're saying, I'm not a boy, I'm a girl.
They are telling their friends how to identify and speak to them.
All right. Well, people came from all over the world to that event. They took photos, shared in the legacy of that gay bar where patrons resisted a police raid that sparked protests and longer term organizing that made the cause of LGBTQ rights considerably more visible. Cyndi Lauper sang her hit True Colors, its chorus declaring, "Your true colors are beautiful like a rainbow." You've been listening to International Edition. That does it for today's show, but you can find us anytime at voanews.com. We thank you very much for joining us. And thanks to our director, Tracy Carter, and our engineer, Jimmy Cook. I'm Lori London in Washington. Have a great day.